time once again for Community Forum, and we're very lucky to have with us live in the studios this morning Nick Licata. Nick Licata is Seattle City Council member and an incumbent candidate coming up in this next election cycle for same seat, position 6. Nick, thank you very much for coming and spending time with us this morning.
Well, thank you for having me.
Start out and tell us, why are you choosing to run again for Seattle City Council?
Well, I gave it quite a bit of thought, actually. I was thinking about all kinds of things that I'd like to do to, as they would say, change the world, make it a better place. I've really enjoyed being on the City Council. And as I was evaluating my future, and I actually do this every 4 years, whenever I run, I tell myself, I'm not going to run again because I want to make sure that I'm not having anything over my head as far as looking back and making, you know, worrying about the decisions I'm making, who I might be upsetting or whatever, something like that. And then as I was on the council and thinking about not just my options, but the options also how they would affect my community, I realized that I serve a unique purpose on the council. I continually found myself asking questions that the other council members were not asking, and not just asking the questions, but actually digging in and getting information that was not available to the public, that no one else was really pursuing. And I kept asking myself, how will decisions be shaped in the future if quite honestly, someone like myself wasn't there pushing the agenda of open government, pushing the agenda of, look, where's these tax dollars being spent? Are they being spent for the common good? And saying basically, are we ignoring certain communities? Are we just pumping all our money into one area of town? And there was no one else doing that. And I felt that it was needed. I had to continue doing those things to make sure that Seattle, as we grow, and you know, despite this recession, we will be growing. We grow in a way that really takes into account people who are just working average people.
So that actually brings up one of the criticisms that people often like to throw out about yourself, in that you're always that, or pretty much always that lone vote going the other way. So it seemed like you just answered that right there.
Well, you know, it's funny because I don't deny that's the image, and I probably have myself to blame because I point that out. But the reality is that actually I have fewer lone votes than other council members. There are, in fact, we went through, and just to be curious as far as how these votes go in the last 3 years, you know, something like two or three other council members have had more lone votes than I have had. And I've probably been on the winning side on more often than over half the council. But there's a difference. Often when a council member takes an 8-to-1 vote, they really don't talk about it very much. They're almost like, I'm going to say embarrassed, but they sort of vote no and they walk away. And it's not that I beat on my chest when I take a 1-8 vote, but usually it's on an important topic. And I explain to my constituents and the public why I voted a certain way. And as a result, you know, the press covers it because it makes sense. In fact, one of the other council members came up to me and said, you know, it's really interesting. When you take a vote that, you know, you're in the minority, and not necessarily 8-to-1, it could be a 7-to-2 or even a 6-to-3, I end up usually being the person that they interview. One, I'm accessible. A lot of council members don't like talking to press. But secondly, because I actually have a rationale for why I'm voting the way I do. And newspaper reporters or media people usually get it. Oh, yeah, okay, I understand how it works now. And then it gets played in the media, and then people remember it.
So who do you consider your constituents?
Well, you know, it's, again, it's sort of an interesting question. You know, sometimes people try to categorize folks as, well, the environmentalists are my constituency, or the union people are my constituency, or, you know, the elderly. And I have strong support amongst all three of those categories of people. But I also, you know, when the polling was done, it's sort of interesting. I actually pull pretty well amongst people who consider themselves independents or Republicans, perhaps libertarians, because, you know, I'm an issue, for instance, of drug reform, looking at marijuana laws and going down the road that 14 states have gone down to, you know, decriminalize it. And that appeals to a lot of folks who don't like big government. You know, I'm opposed to some major public works projects that don't pencil out for providing real public benefits, but in fact benefit just the the landowners that are next to those public projects. And strangely enough, the Republicans or business types who aren't directly benefiting from those projects like what I have to say. You know, I was surprised to see there was a columnist in a newspaper, Bill Virgin, I think the Seattle Times, very astute business writer, business columnist, and he didn't actually cite me, but he cited all my arguments for why we have to be careful when we pump in literally millions and millions of dollars into one limited community, in this case it was South Lake Union, and ask ourselves, what are we trying to do? Trying to control the private economy? Because we can't, and we don't know what the future is going to bring because we don't control it. You know, it's a national economy. And so we have to ask ourselves, this is the best place we can put all of our public dollars or an inappropriate amount? And that's what I've been saying. And he was pointing out that, you know, it's sort of a fool's game to go chasing after something like that. And it ties in actually to my campaign, too, because my opponents who are raising, I must admit, money from folks who, you know, I would say have deep pockets and won't feel the pinch of digging into their deep pockets and distributing the wealth to other folks, not me. The argument that they make, which is not an accurate one, is, either trying to obstruct progress. Actually, they don't use progress. I think obstruct getting things done. And the other argument is, let's just get things done. And to me, that's sort of the argument you use if you're basically not thinking. It's sort of like the cheerleader who continues to cheer when the team moves on the field and the next team comes on and they never paid attention. They're still, you know, with the pom-poms cheerleading. And again, that's the reason I think that there should be at least one council member who consistently, because other council members from time to time ask questions, as they should, and do their homework, as they should, but I think I've been more consistent in applying those principles than others. Do you want someone who's going to not just be a cheerleader for the next thing that comes along, but says, wait a second, what are we getting here in exchange for our, in quote, progress or for our investment? And unfortunately, that's a little of a more of a subtle, I would say, message. It's not as clear a message as just standing up in front of a crowd and saying, let's get things done.
What was your original motivation to run and be part of city council?
Well, actually, I was involved as a citizen activist even when I was for 15 years an insurance broker, which is sort of funny. One columnist took a funny swipe at me, saying this is the best Seattle can do for a radical or a progressive, someone who's been an insurance broker. But as a civic activist, community activist, organizer, what do you want to call it? I was involved from things like, there's an issue called redlining, where banks basically were at those days headed branches that were taking deposits and then were investing the money outside the community, and the community is basically being sucked dry of their capital. And it was not an initially easy concept to understand, but then obviously it grew in support. And working with other community leaders, we got the state law changed and the federal law changed. And I actually went back to Congress in D.C. and testified and had my input into that law. But so that sort of got me involved in being engaged in government decision making. I was involved on a national, and then I was head of WASHPIRG at one time, Washington Public Interest Research Group, and Ralph Nader Group, and was involved trying to get double line tankers in Puget Sound to stop oil spills. Or at least help prevent oil spills. And then just before I got on the council, I was involved in the controversial group, Citizens for More Important Things, which basically said, hey, do we need to put in $500 million to build a stadium for a baseball team that's, you know, going to use it, 40 days out of the year? And what's the public getting out of that huge investment? Shouldn't there be a little more private investment? So it was never against public investment. It was just saying that, what's the ratio here and what's the benefits? Again, that's sort of a thoughtful approach. And then we actually initiated, began an initiative. We got enough signatures on, got on the ballot, and we're outspent like 50-1. And we actually won the initiative. We were surprised, won the initiative vote. And of course, the folks that had a lot of money, they were invested in the team, and I would say the identified community leaders by the major media who supported this, spending the public money, said this is a horrible thing, that the public got the wrong message, even though they were the people on the other side were outspending us 50-1. And they went to the state legislature, and literally within a week, they overturned the vote. And I think that was the kind of response that I think undermines people's confidence or faith in government.
All right. So what do you see as the critical issues facing the city of Seattle right now?
Well, to a certain extent, they're always the same issues. I mean, I collect political literature, and you go back to the year after year or cycle after cycle, and the critical issues many times don't really change all that much. It's how you approach them. It's transportation, the need for public transportation, the need to stop congestion, the need to address public safety, the need to make sure that we apply our tax dollars in a way that really benefit all the communities, at least to a certain extent, rather than just a few. But specifically in down the road, probably the number one issue we're facing and have been facing for a while is the replacement of the Alaskan Way Viaduct. And it's one of those issues that politicians somewhat like to avoid because as you're touching it, you're going to get burned. And there's no one who's really happy with any solution to the Alaskan Way Viaduct. The split vote, a dual vote that went to before the public, which I thought was a waste of time because, neither one of them was going to offer a complete solution, was do you want a cut and tunnel slash surface, or do you want to rebuild the viaduct as it is? And I think a lot of folks wanted something that was elevated, that was not as bulky and monstrous. And other folks probably wanted something that was not going to be as expensive as an underground tunnel. So anyhow, the surface tunnel was defeated overwhelmingly. I think they only got 30% of the vote, and the rebuild was like in the 40s. So neither of them passed. And led to more confusion. And then when the governor put together a task force, they didn't even recommend the deep bore tunnel. They came out of the clear blue, I guess, in some ways. And I think it's because, in some ways, because the public never voted on it, they could go forward with it. But I think you have to be somewhat a realist. If the governor signed off on it, the state legislature has, and the council has, and the mayor and the county executive and the county government, it's probably what's going to happen. The critical thing now is it's at less than 5% design. So we need to make sure that it works for the north end and the south end, that it works for freight, and also that the state actually ponies up the money, because the local community cannot afford the tunnel, and particularly if there's cost overruns. So we should be prepared with Plan B, and I'm saying a year from now, if they don't have answers for where the costs are for the more completed design work, then we do need to look at an alternative. So that's going to be around for a while. Overall, it's a question of how you make Seattle more affordable for families. Seattle is undergoing a tremendous amount of change and has been for a while. We were part of the real estate speculative bubble. Both in the commercial and the residential sector. People don't realize that. We just have built over 5 million square feet of retail office space. It's empty. And we've got another 5 million literally under construction, which probably will be completed by the end of the year. It looks like we'll have as high as 20% vacancy rate in office space. And that's because, again, people felt that the economy is hot, let's build. Same thing goes on with apartments and condos. Condos in particular were hit really hard. So when you overbuild like that, and you basically what you're doing is you're increasing the value of the land. You take land that is considered to be not of the highest use, and if we go with zoning where we're upzoning areas that don't need to be upzoned, you end up with a push to get rid of manufacturing, industrial, maritime industries, which basically provide a lot of working wages for families, and to take those businesses out of the circulation, and you, in some cases, don't even build, you just wipe them out and keep the land vacant as a parking lot waiting for something to happen. Or you put up buildings that you have to wait for the next cycle of boom for them to be filled, and then you narrow the base of the city. So to make Seattle affordable, we have to make sure we have a balance between making sure that we do retain our industrial, maritime, and manufacturing areas, that we don't just try to develop them overnight into hotels or residences and things of that sort. We need to make sure that we, when we spend our public funds, we don't end up trying to throw everything onto the ratepayers, for instance. Seattle City Light and our water utility have taken in too many projects that don't need to be taken in, and they end up throwing more costs to our ratepayers. And then we need to make sure that as we move forward with our efforts to build more low-income housing, we need to make sure those low-income housing units are more affordable for the long period of time. I was successful in getting legislation passed that basically says when we look at the housing levy, rather than looking at 20 years or 30 years, look at 50 years plus. And that means that more families receive low-income housing because of the turnover, and it means that you're taking that that housing out of the what I call the commodity market, no longer the commodity. Actually, you reserve it for low-income. And also that we really use our money more for low-income families, so those earning 30% or 60% less, not trying to chase the upper income brackets for families. And lastly, regarding another controversial issue, is the potential jail. I initiated some programs that the council supported, which basically looked at how do we keep people out of jail permanently by IDing those people who are most often offenders and try to stabilize their lives. You know, the biggest problem that folks have who end up doing criminal activity, and often it's petty criminal activity, and they go in and out of jail for years, is a stable housing. They just don't have housing. They're couch surfing, or they're homeless, or they're crashing with someone. So we designed a program that ID'd those folks, gave them housing, gave them opportunities for employment, gave them opportunities. In many cases, they had severe medical needs. They could be mental. That could be basic things that lead to addiction. And stabilize their lives. And we found is that the vast majority of those people end up not going back to criminal activity. So there's less of a demand for jail use. If you go down the route of just, let's just hire more police, let's build more jails, let's throw more people in jails who basically are creating a nuisance on the street, you end up basically in a huge, what's benignly called criminal justice system with the emphasis on the criminal, not the justice, where you basically you're throwing in hundreds of millions of dollars into a system that is not going to work. It's like the war on drugs. You don't end up reducing drug usage. You don't end up reducing illegal drug trades. You just simply end up building a new industry and more people being employed as jailers and more people spending their lives in jail as opposed to getting the underlying causes and reducing the jail population and stabilizing the people who are drifting into crime to allow them to get housing and start becoming productive citizens and getting jobs and working.
All right, let me throw the other most repeated criticism of you at you and see what you think. That being the you were a big proponent and supporter of the monorail, which turned into a major fiasco and debacle. What do you think about that? Do you actually see the monorail as a disaster, and would you have done anything differently about that?
Well, there were, was it, four or five votes? I think they won all the votes but the last one. And actually, in the case of the monorail, both myself and Jan Drago saw it as a infrastructure that would actually reduce congestion. And I still believe it had been done right. It would have succeeded. In fact, it would have helped with regards to when we replaced the viaduct, the critical connection from West Seattle to downtown and from the north to downtown would have been addressed by the monorail. It's funny, the biggest criticism of the monorail, there are two. One on the finances, which I think eventually sank it, is that the headline ran how much it would cost and was far above what they estimated, and that's because they included debt service. But if you apply the same numbers to Sound Transit is in a bigger mess or debacle if you think about it as far as strictly financial terms. I mean, Sound Transit's costing over twice the amount, is half the distance, and presumably half the number of people traveling on it. But there was a recognition in the community that Sound Transit was needed because it's a fixed rail system, and the monorail is a fixed rail system. The other major criticism of the monorail was the going through downtown, Second Avenue in particular, and degrading the urban environment. One time there was a suggestion that the monorail work on either the south end to downtown and the north end to downtown and just not do the core area. I initially thought that didn't make sense, but later on I came around to the idea that it did make sense to basically do the monorail on a shorter route. And that was, I think, the critical mistake that the monorail board made. They should have gone with a shorter route, just like Sound Transit did. It would have been subject to the same arguments that you're paying more for what you get. But I think as a system, it would have worked that way, and it would have shown that it could carry enough people to justify its cost over time. But, it's the folks that came out against the monorail are in some ways very interesting. They're saying the people with particularly, I'd say, the investors who came out against the monorail are the same investors, for the most part, who supported Sound Transit. So the difference in some way is that the monorail did not have the major development corporations that support Sound Transit, because Sound Transit technology is basically trained technology. It's been around for 100 years. And that industry is well developed throughout the country. They have major engineering firms, major law firms, and so they have a good lobbying group. The monorail is more of a unique technology, and certainly it would have employed a lot of people from the manufacturing and from the industrial section, but they're not as well coalesced in a definable lobbying group because it's basically a much smaller base for technology. So they never really had the political push and the political leverage that the light rail had.
All right. So how much do city council members rely on citizen input and action in getting policies and legislation enacted?
Well, actually, surprisingly, more than people recognize. A lot of issues... City Council does take into account citizen input, and they often, I would say, amend legislation to accommodate, particularly if it's a neighborhood, particular neighborhood interest. I was successful recently, for instance, there is a element having to do with major construction in neighborhoods, particularly around Sound Transit, actually. And it was amendments to the current noise ordinance. And there were communities that were concerned about certain elements, and there were compromises made to amend the legislation. And probably not enough for some folks, but one of the things I was able to get into, for instance, is make sure that communities have an opportunity to actually make an appeal to the hearing examiner, which is an important process that was not there in the legislation. So, and the council went along with that. There's often push for the citizens on various kinds of budget items, certainly in the social service area, the human services area, a push for money to be spent on meeting various needs there, and I think the council responded quite well, particularly in the area of food banks. We added additional money for food banks that the mayor did not have. In the area of the libraries, the council has consistently responded to the public by adding more money for the collections, which is critical to keep people into the libraries. And that's one of the areas I championed, and the council responded to that need. I think that the place where the public probably doesn't get as much response from the console are what I would say are these particularly large multi-million-dollar public projects, which to a certain extent don't really, and often don't really impact one singular community. I mean, Mercer Project is probably the best example. Although it has an indirect impact on the whole transportation system within the city because it drains money away from projects that should be used, like bike paths and bike trails around the city that will not be able to be spent because it will be going spent on Mercer, and because of sidewalk improvements that will not be able to be spent, or road improvements that will not be able to be spent. All that stuff will be going into Mercer. But it's hard to draw those lines. When I went out and talked to communities and explained that, the overwhelming support was to scale down Mercer and redesign it for something that was more useful and allow money to be spent in other parts of the city. I had over a dozen, two dozen community groups supporting that position. But that's not their major issue. Major issues for many community groups really are more zoning issues and more issues dealing with their immediate boundaries. So it didn't have the endurance that the folks on the other side who want to pursue that major project continue on. So what it comes down to is that on big projects where you really have a concentration of, I'd say, a much smaller group of lobbyists, not necessarily formal lobbyists, but lobbyists who are, many times major campaign contributors or people who are seen as civic leaders by the council members, are pushing for something, the opposition doesn't have an opportunity to coalesce around it. And so individual communities around the city that may not benefit from it don't really get heard. And part of the reason they don't get heard is because they're not getting information. And that's why I've often argued that you can't make good decisions unless you have truly open government and decision-making that's transparent and gets information out to the public. It all fits together. If you don't tell the public what the impact is of the decisions they're making, you end up with basically the public going along with projects that do not directly benefit them.
Only 2 minutes left. So if you were... assuming you were out of the city council and you were advising people how to best work with city council to get something enacted, what would you advise them to do?
Well, real simple messages are, for instance, get some of your neighbors together, if it's that, or other people who are of similar interests. Find out who the who the council member is who heads the committee that is your subject area. Ask to meet with that person. Even if that council member can't meet with you, meet with their legislative assistants. And then when you go in, bring a one-page summary of what your concern is, what your solution you're proposing is, whether it's a budget item or whether it's a change in the law. And then make sure you have the ask. Too often people go in to just complain, but they don't really know what they want the council member to do. So always be prepared to say, this is what I would like you to do. And the council member then will ask you, have you talked to other council members? And you can say, well, you're the first. We'll talk to the others. And then go back to that council member and say, we have talked to the others, and this is where they're coming from. They agree with us or they don't for these reasons. So stay engaged. And you will get results. Council members, I think, really do listen to a certain extent, you know, on things that they feel that they have some impact on.
We are talking with Nick Licata. He is a Seattle City Councilman, and he is running continuing his seat at Seattle City Council, Position 6. Nick, how can people find out more about your campaign?
Well, they can go to my website, which is www.nicklicata, that's L-I-C-A-T-A, 2009.com, and there they can read about all the legislation I've pushed for and got passed. They can push a button and sign up to walk. I'm asking for folks to, if they don't have money, just walk their neighborhood and distribute my literature. Or they can make a contribution online as well. And then they can also call at 453-9168. That's a 206 number, 453-9168. And they can send an email to votelicata09@gmail.com.
All right. Well, with that, we are out of time. I want to thank you very much for coming and spending time with us this morning.
Well, thank you very much. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk to you and your audience.
Again, just talking with Nick Licata, Seattle City Councilman, running for re-election, and you can find out more via his website, nicklicata2009.com.